Welcome to Challenging Colonialism, a podcast dedicated to amplifying the voices of Indigenous California. An important note from the start, the producers are two white male educator academics, and these are not our stories. This podcast will center Native voices, and our intention is to highlight the significant work being done by Indigenous communities to challenge ongoing colonialism, and to broadcast information about the resistance and resilience of Indigenous California in the past, the present, and the future.
Recently, there has been a wave of exciting new books written by Indigenous Californian scholars. In order to support these important scholars and their studies, a series of upcoming episodes of the Challenging Colonialism podcast will feature interviews with some of these scholars speaking about their work. These researchers are challenging the legacies of colonialism and making their stories accessible to our listeners. If you find their work as compelling as we do and would like to learn more, please consider reading their work, which we will link to in our episode notes. This episode features Dr. Yves Chavez, who contributed to our very first episode about the mission bells found along the California highways and the Indigenous-led movement to remove them. Dr. Chavez is an associate professor of visual arts at the University of Oklahoma, and her book, Indigenizing California, Mission Art and Architecture, is available now from the University of Washington Press. I want to welcome you here to the podcast. We can start by having you share a little bit about yourself and telling us a little bit about why you conducted this study and got involved with this.
Well, thank you for the invitation to do this interview. And we know each other from previous projects, but for listeners who don't know me, I'm Eve Chavez. I'm now associate professor at the University of Oklahoma. And I am a member of the Gabrielino Tongva San Gabriel Band of Mission Indians. We are one of the Gabrielino groups in the Los Angeles Basin. And being part of that community also means I am a descendant of mission survivors, specifically Mission San Gabriel, which was built in our ancestral homelands starting in the late 1700s. And my connection to the community is through my maternal grandmother, who I talk about in the book as one of my main sources of inspiration for doing this research. My grandmother's name was Vivian Morales, married name was Barthelemy, and she was somebody who shared with me about our culture and relationship to the mission. And growing up, that was a site that I connected to our culture in the absence of a reservation. We're not federally recognized, as are many of the missionized coastal California communities. Most of us don't have reservations, and the mission, despite its very complicated history, is a place, at least to me, is somewhere I can relate to my ancestors because I know they are buried there. Many of them were buried in the Mission Cemetery, and it's also a place where they lived. They built the mission, they practiced their culture and adapted to foreign imposition on their culture. So that's mainly why I pursued this topic. And then I'm an art historian. So from an art historian's perspective, I wanted to look at the visual practices that my ancestors and related communities were engaging in before, during, and after California's mission era.
Great. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. You know, kind of building along those lines, you opened the preface of the book with a story about your grandmother. And in the story, you expressed disappointment that she had expressed disappointment that she couldn't be buried at Mission San Gabriel. And then later in the introduction, you talk about, you say, quote, this study seeks to explain why the descendants of mission survivors retain a connection to these places to this day, despite colonial trauma. I think it's such an interesting quote. And I wonder if you could share for listeners about this complexity, right, of the missions, their legacies, and how descendant communities grapple with that, and also about how your book seeks to unpack this.
Yeah, the part about my grandmother was timely, especially given that she passed away in 2015 as I was finishing my dissertation, and she knew prior to her passing that she wouldn't be buried at the Mission Cemetery, which I think at that time had finally reopened the option to be buried there. It's a very small cemetery, and in the, I guess it, this was the early 80s when her husband, my grandfather, passed away. There, the mission was not allowing new burials. Now, I think with cremation being allowed by the Catholic Church, they are allowing it again, but they had already reserved burial plots at a different cemetery. But my sense, and I wish in retrospect that I had asked her to expand on that more, my understanding is that she wanted to be in the place where her parents were buried, where her relatives' ancestors had been buried, that there was this more personal connection than just some other cemetery in the Los Angeles area. So it was about that family connection. And listeners may be, making the connection like, well, this is a Catholic practice. This is a Catholic church cemetery that we're talking about. So there is that element to the complexity as well of the relationship that Native people, some Native people have to these sites. In the case of my family, my grandmother and grandfather were married in the Mission Church, the old church. San Gabriel has two churches. There is the old one, and then there was a newer one built at some point in the 20th century. And there is that conflicting relationship, I think, that some Native people have found themselves navigating, that some of the ancestors and some living Native people today have been Catholic, practicing Catholics, but can also be critical of the Catholic Church, especially in the historical sense, recognizing that the early church leadership, mainly the Franciscans who introduced Catholicism to California and our communities, were they were human. They were flawed individuals, and there were a select few who were more sympathetic to our communities, but there were others who were not, and that has been documented. Junipero Serra, for instance, being one of the main Franciscans, encouraging corporal punishment of Native people when they didn't conform to the expectations of the Catholic Church or the Spanish crown. So there is this tendency, people nowadays or in more recent history, to paint a picture of the missions as very black and white, that there are some promoters of mission history that romanticize them, see them as these tourist destinations with bucolic gardens, and as other scholars have written about, those are not a realistic image of what the missions really looked like back in the late 18th, early 19th centuries. These were workspaces. And then on the other hand, you have some people who are very critical, both community members, allies, scholars. See the negative aspects of the missions, and they were sites of genocide. They were places where Native people experienced violence, endured disease imposed by the foreign settlers. So you have these two narratives, but very rarely does the public or academic audiences hear choices that Native people were faced with making to survive and how, because those survivors made certain choices in the past, there's this sort of trickle down effect to today where you still have community members who maintain a relationship with the missions because these are some of the only spaces where we can still remember our ancestors, like in the form of the cemetery or in the buildings themselves that our ancestors constructed. So that's part of the complexity that I'm trying to examine in the book, which is only a small piece of the larger history for all of California. There were, as you know, 21 missions built in California. I'm only looking at a select group in Southern California.
Yeah, it's such a complex thing, and I know in my interviewing people, conversations with California Indian folks, descendants from missions, it's everyone has a different relationship with that, and for some these are places that are super important because of their ancestors having been there, and for others, right, that's they're traumatic places that are difficult to go in, and I think. It's important for all of us non-native people to understand that there's a range of experience with that, and and that it's a very complex thing. So yeah, thank you for helping to break that down and share about that too. I think your book does a great job in so many ways, of so many things. But one of the things it does really well is it helps to break down kind of stereotypes. And here in California, as somebody who grew up in LA, like I know I was told a lot of really awful stereotypes, racist ideas about indigenous peoples in general, certainly ideas of indigenous peoples as hunter-gatherers, without complex society, without things like art and culture. And this is the way that I was taught, growing up in the 80s and 90s. And I think your book does a really beautiful job of pushing back on these notions. I wonder if you could speak to some of the many artistic expressions of California Indian peoples and culture. Just thinking, prior to Spanish occupation and, what was going on.
Yeah, when I was reading your question about the hunter-gatherer trope, I immediately thought of anthropology and how, as a discipline, anthropology has been sort of the scapegoat for sustaining that narrative, though I think a lot of credit should be given to recent scholars who have been shifting that narrative. So I certainly cannot take credit for being the first. I owe a lot of credit to people who have influenced my work, scholars Sim Schneider, Lee Panich, Peter Nelson at Berkeley is doing important work too. So there are scholars who are shifting that very anthropology-based narrative about California Indians and also have made it possible, I would say, in a sense, for me as an art historian, though I work in a different discipline, but we're also material based in that I can center material and visual culture as evidence for understanding California Indian practices in the past so that we can highlight these complexities of what the ancestors were doing. And you were asking, can I speak to the artistic expressions of California Indian people and culture prior to Spanish colonization? So it's challenging, right? That there were no written records California Indian people were making. It's not like in Mexico where they had the codices that documented certain practices. That wasn't the case in California. So we have to rely on the physical record. What do the objects tell us about what people are doing? But also bring in some of the written record from non-native explorers who were coming initially, writing about what they saw. And then, of course, into the colonial period, what the colonizers were writing as well, taking those accounts with a grain of salt, of course, but looking at Stonework is one of the few more permanent examples of California Indian visual practice that would have lasted longer. Baskets are more challenging to study because they're ephemeral. They're made out of plant materials, so they are more subject to decomposition, and in some cases, they were burned in funeral practices or buried. So baskets tend to be more from the colonial period that we are able to study, but we know they had antecedents prior to that Spanish occupation. Shell work is also something that has more longevity. There is evidence of shell work in a variety of contexts that California Indian people along the coast, like in my community, were using abalone shell for personal adornment, for ceremonial contexts, also to decorate ceremonial objects. I talk about a Chumash example in the book, how the Chumash were still using abalone shell to adorn ceremonial objects that they would use in processions on Catholic feast days. Also, we know that there was rock art, that there were petroglyphs and pictographs that the Chumash and other California Indian communities left behind as evidence of their visual practices. And the term art is tricky, right? There is disagreement within art history as a discipline about what counts as art, what is fine art, what is craft or folk art. But I choose to talk about these practices, certain ones, as art to recognize the creative genius of the makers, if we can say that they were expressing individual design choices. This was not anything mass-produced. Thinking about baskets, you have baskets with unique designs that can be linked to individual makers, whether or not we know their names. Basket scholars have been able to identify certain stylistic elements that are unique to certain weavers. So in that regard, I would say these are artists, people who had very advanced skill sets that they had learned from their ancestors. So there could have been an apprenticeship system in place as well. So I think a lot of that sort of system tends to be associated with a European context, but I would say California Indians certainly had an established system for passing on their knowledge and understanding of how to manipulate materials in expressive forms.
Yeah, thank you. And I find that so interesting too. I think the ways that even we conceive of the concept of art, right? Which it's so easy to take these things as a given. It's like, okay, this is what art is, and not recognize like the way that these ideas are very culturally constructed, right? They're very we have these Western concepts of what constitute arts that are built around kind of Western history, and often just kind of, leave out other artistic expressions. So I think that's another area where your book intervenes, right? Where you're trying to kind of question that, right? And to bring into this question. And I think you do that in a lot of different ways. And, thinking about that, the missions, the next question I have for you is about the mission spaces themselves and visiting them. But, you mentioned before there's these 21 missions. They've become these massive tourist destinations. The renovations of those being tied to really the rise of tourism in California, right? As people have studied and illuminated. But in these renovations, right? And you were just talking about this, but the indigenous presence and histories have been thoroughly erased, right? In so many examples. But you do a great job of bringing light to what is missed through this kind of erasure and the reconstruction of these spaces. I wonder if you could speak a little bit about The presence and persistence of Indigenous artistry that we can still see in these spaces. How can people who visit these spaces still see that that history and presence there?
Yeah, and I think that's there's a distinction that can be made too, in that not every example of Indigenous artwork or artistry is still visible at the missions themselves, because so many materials were taken, the belongings were taken to mainly Europe, some were sent to Mexico. So not everything is still there. So in the book, I talk about baskets, for instance, that are now removed from these sites. But in terms of what you can see as a tourist when visiting the missions, include the use of local pigments. In more recent years, mission walls have been repainted. Really, over the centuries, they've been repainted. So the original paint is harder to see, but there have been attempts to repaint some of the walls to replicate how they originally looked, thinking about the church at Mission Santa Barbara, how the walls have been attributed to Native artists. They're quite colorful, mainly in the lower register of the walls. And it's thought that those were painted originally using local pigments. And even the whitewashing that was done on mission walls, whether those were within the arcades or interior walls, those were used. The materials to make the whitewashing came from local sources. And I think this is something Sim Schneider has talked about, using shells from the coast. So, in a way, that's almost like a form of an indigenous, not necessarily intervention, but just contribution, right? That Native people were using locally available materials. And even at Mission San Juan Capistrano, which I don't discuss in the book, but I've written about in a separate publication, you can see actual shells and pieces of coral in the mortar at within the walls of the basilica that still stand, this basilica being the original church structure that was destroyed in the earthquake. But there you can see Native people were using materials that would have held significance to them prior to the Spanish occupation. So you can look for little things like that, which maybe weren't even meant to be subversive, but just made sense to these Native people who were using materials at their disposal. In some cases, there may have been more subversive action on the part of the artists. Thinking back to the Mission San Juan Capistrano example, there are some instances of figures painted on the walls of the arcades within the grounds there, which have not received a whole lot of attention, but could have been a subversive choice. It's unclear. Again, we don't know the intentionality of all these makers because they didn't leave a written record, but there are some subtle elements like that. Or thinking about in the book how I talk about the stonework, you have examples of the fountainheads at Mission Santa Barbara, which are in the shape of local fauna, local animals, the bear and the mountain lion being reminiscent of animals that Chumash people and other coastal California Indians would have seen in the region. And then more subtle examples of indigenous artistry would be the sculptures of the saint figure, Santa Barbara, and then the theological virtues at Mission Santa Barbara, which, if you didn't know as a visitor, might just assume maybe they were imported from Spain or something because they're Catholic subject matter, but they have been attributed to a Native artist. So there is a lot of complexity again to what counts as Indigenous artistry. Is it overtly Indigenous in the sense of being something that you would have seen prior to Spanish occupation, or is it something that displays Indigenous skill sets or materiality, but the subject matter is now reflective of that outside European influence?
Yeah. I think of those the stone kind of carvings in front of Mission Santa Barbara, and the listener may not know, but the Santa Barbara Mission is home to like the archives, the big archive for all the missions. So I spent a lot of time there in my research period. And never, I mean, I noticed those, but never really paid much attention to them until I heard that from you and read your work. And it made me kind of look very differently as I walked through that space. And they're very present. I mean, there are these kind of basins right out from front there that I think are, every time I've ever been there, I see a lot of people coming to visit there, but they're all kind of at the building and very rarely are out there in front there. But yeah, I think that if you're looking with the right way and kind of thinking along the lines that you're suggesting, I think that the experience of actually being in those spaces is very different. You can start to notice those things. But it's so helpful to have that pointed out. Great. Well, you make a point in the introduction there. You talk about how the California mission narratives have been very tightly controlled by the Catholic Church historically, and how few of these spaces today are open to including any perspectives of California Indian peoples. And I wonder if you could maybe just expand on that a little bit.
That's a tricky question, right? It's reflective of a very complicated history, relationship between the Catholic Church and our communities. And I don't mean to criticize all representatives of the Catholic Church. There are representatives at the missions who are doing important work, are working with our communities. Thinking about Santa Barbara, how there have been administrators there and in the archives who have worked with our communities. But there is still this overarching narrative that presents the Franciscan missionaries in mainly a positive light. And there is this disconnect, I think, that hasn't been addressed in terms of who was responsible for establishing the missions back to the late 18th century versus the church today. That the people in the past made certain choices for their political reasons of representing the Spanish crown. And then you have the church today. Pope Francis, when he was still alive, had started to make efforts to communicate with Indigenous communities in places like Canada, trying to begin conversations leading towards apologies. And I think there was some hope within California that we would hear something, but that didn't really come to fruition, unfortunately. And he also canonized Junipero Serra, which was met with a lot of resistance within the California Indian community, though not all. Some people supported that decision, but I think the more vocal members of the California Indian community, the scholarly community, allies, were against that decision, given that Junipero Serra had such a contested relationship with not just California Indians and other Indigenous people, but also the church itself at the time when he was the father president. As you know from your historical research, that back in the late 18th century, he was a complicated figure. So, because in 2015, when the canonization happened, there was such a negative reaction with protests of varying degrees. There has been this effort among church leadership to really kind of double down on that decision to canonize him and really promote Sarah as this sort of mascot of the missions without taking into account his whole character. And it's unfortunate because it kind of overshadows other Franciscans who, in some cases, were more sympathetic to Native people. And then you have this division of voices who are only promoting a very sanitized history that doesn't address the shortcomings of the Franciscan order and the Catholic Church in a late 18th, early 19th century context, and how people feel today that there could still be apologies made on the part of the Catholic Church to recognize bad choices were made in the past. That doesn't necessarily mean that the Catholic Church can't operate the missions today, but why not recognize their predecessors made choices that harmed California Indian and other indigenous people. So I think there is this unfortunate reluctance on the part of certain church leaders to admit fault. And because of that, I think there is this assumption that California Indians are all going to be antagonistic towards the missions, that if the church were to let in more California Indian community members into their spaces, the museum spaces today, that there's going to be a hostile reaction when we can be cooperative. We have relationships as tribes with the local mission churches within our homelands, but for some reason, well, the reasons I outlined, those perspectives are not being treated with the respect that they could be as equally across the 21 missions. So again, I don't mean to say that all the missions are the same. All of them have different relationships with the tribes, but I think there is this sort of assumption that California Indians are going to somehow totally shift the narrative and paint this negative picture of the Catholic Church without acknowledging these nuances that I've been discussing.
Yeah, you bring up what I think is a really interesting point too about the way that when the point of view is only glorifying or only romanticizing these padres, then there's no the whole picture is skewed, right? Obviously, we know that some of them were abusive, right, and did awful things and were punished by it by the church, some cases, and others were not punished by it, but. When we don't kind of allow for that nuance historically to say, hey, some of these were bad actors who did awful things, and then there are some who actually did care. Those that did really good stuff or that, documented language and kind of, really tried to kind of pay attention to and learn from, that gets erased too, right? Any of the good works when it becomes this kind of monolithic way of looking. No, I think that's a really important point that doesn't get talked about very often. Yeah, thank you. You share a lot of examples of this in your book, but I wonder if you could share a little bit about how Indigenous artists engaged through their artwork in a way to kind of continue with traditional practices, how we can see this some of these examples as a way to kind of resist colonial occupation and assimilation.
Yeah, so in addition to art in the more portable sense of what we consider art, I also talk about architecture. So, one example that came to mind when I was reading your question is the quiche, which is our willow-framed dome-shaped house. Along the California coast, there are various versions. I know the Luiseno have a similar name for their home structure. The Chumash call it an op. So at Mission San Gabriel, there is archaeological evidence that these structures were still being built and lived in up through the 19th century, and there is even photographic evidence into the early 20th century from the San Gabriel region and down to the Luiseno Payam-Cuisham homelands of indigenous people still living in these tule thatch structures. That these were the types of structures the ancestors had lived in prior to the Spanish occupation and well after the introduction of more permanent architecture, which was one of the tools of colonization that the Spanish used through the Franciscans to impose their presence on our homelands. That you have this sort of dichotomy of the Catholic Church, which at many of the sites ended up being this sort of adobe hybrid structure, sometimes with stone bricks, blocks. And then nearby, you'd see the ephemeral structure of the willow framed dome house, which would elements. So we can think of that as a form of resistance because the families are resisting a more foreign European model of living, especially the dormitories where young unmarried women were forced to live, being locked up at night. But within the quiche style homes, the families could still maintain some degree of autonomy over their lifestyles when they weren't working under the toll of the bell, which we talked about before in the bell conversation. So in a way, using the architecture was a form of resistance because they're also maintaining the knowledge of the plants that they were cultivating to build these structures. So there was that element of resistance as well.
And I mean, even I don't know, it just makes me think a little bit too with the use of the plants. I think that we don't often think of like the impact of like the livestock, right? Of the Spanish livestock, the cows and cattle and horses and sheep and everything that were put onto pasture lands, right? Where so many of these traditional plants were, and so even the ecological world, right, of California was very much under a process of colonization. And so, yeah, like you point out, the use of these plants in traditional ways, in new ways, and the building of these things, I think is a great example of that. Yeah, thank you. And you also in the book you talk a lot about indigenous ingenuity, and you brought this up a little bit earlier too, as well as creativity. And this is something that I rarely see discuss maybe a little bit more recently, like you point out with some of the works of Sim and Lee and others. But it seems like that in particular, ingenuity and creativity get overlooked. And I love how you kind of focus on that here. And I wonder if you could focus on some examples or share some examples in your book about indigenous ingenuity that you found.
Yeah, so I was mentioning earlier the fountainheads at Mission Santa Barbara as an example of Chumash, specifically stone sculpting techniques that were being carried over from prior to the period of occupation. Most of the stonework we know about was done on the Channel Islands in different formats. So the best known examples would be the making of stone bowls and then the effigies or charms, often in the shape of native animals and sea creatures. So I position the fountainheads as sort of a large scale example of Chumash artists applying that skill set but in a different context for a different purpose. And then the wearing of regalia for dances was applied to feast days. And we see this even in South America and in the Peruvian Andean context, that indigenous people throughout the Spanish colonial period were using Catholic feast days, like Saint feast days, and also the Feast of Corpus Christi, as opportunities to maintain ceremonial practices. And I'm careful not to treat the dances or the ceremonies as art, but the body adornment, the regalia that they wore, is an expression of that creativity that they, in the California context, mainly among the Chumash and Tongva, were using bird feathers, shell beads, as a form of body adornment that went well, had a precedent well before Spanish occupation. So that was a creative way to continue those practices so that the colonists wouldn't get upset, right? That they were kind of doing this in a way to appease the Spanish. To them, it was a curiosity. They'd have some foreign visitor come to the mission and they'd tell them, "Oh, well, look at these native people and their dances." But for native people, this was an important opportunity to continue those ceremonies, bring out their, wear their best garments, their best regalia, that otherwise they weren't having safe opportunities to wear. Because if they were doing their ceremonies in unsanctioned settings, then there would have been repercussions. So, in that way, I would say it was their way of expressing ingenuity.
And you include some of those paintings by like folks like Louis Charisse, right? And it's I think it's interesting that we do that there are some of these paintings of some of these dances, right, that were taking place, people in regalia. But I love the way that you're able to kind of take these images that we're fortunate to have, partly because, like you said, they were travelers coming through, and so they would allow for that space for that, but then to understand and kind of think through what was happening underneath them behind all that is, I think, so important. You also write about how so much of the information we have about the California missions has come from non-native sources. And there are a few, very few, right? Only two or three. But these really important exceptions, and one of those is Pablo Toc. Could you share a little bit about Pablo Toc, and what, and specifically what you learned from his writings?
Well, Pablo Toc was not from my community. He was from the Payom Cuishom or Luiseno community. So I would defer to his community members to be more expert on their culture and what he was documenting. But his writings were useful to understand the choices that Native people were making within the mission context in terms of what they could practice. And there was an example that I referred to in the book where he's saying something about the elders and how the elders would only allow their community members to dance on certain days. And this was in the mission era. So that gave me the sense that there was still an awareness that they had to maintain indigenous values, that it wasn't as if a switch was flipped as soon as Catholicism was introduced. That, yes, I know Pablo Toc has been positioned as this sort of colonized figure. He was studying for the priesthood in Rome when he passed away, so there was a bias to his writings. He was still a native person who was raised with an understanding of how to respect his elders, and that comes through in his writings. And I think, he's not representative of all California Indian people at the time, but can kind of give us a sense of maybe how others were feeling that despite having to accommodate the foreign religion, the foreign visitors, settlers, colonizers, whatever you want to call them, desires to be entertained or what have you, that there was still a sense that you had to be selective in what you could display in terms of your culture. And this has been documented among other indigenous communities, thinking about the Pueblos in New Mexico, even into the early 20th century, when anthropologists wanted to document their culture, that Native people have been selective in how much they've shared, that you don't reveal certain religious knowledge that outsiders shouldn't have exposure to. So I think there was that sense I got from his writings. But because, like you were saying, there are not really many sources of a written record from California Indian people at this time, looking at the material record, but even kind of reading between the lines of what the explorers were writing, there was an example I talk about in the book where I think it was a padre, I'm already forgetting, but it was, I think, one of the Franciscans entered a sacred space that they weren't supposed to, and saw a religious figure. I think they called it an idol because, of course, they saw all indigenous religious figures as idols, but they weren't supposed to go in that space. But there was still this acknowledgement that they knew they weren't supposed to be there. And the fact that we don't know any more about the significance of that space indicates, at least to me, that Native people didn't want to divulge that information. They didn't want the foreigners coming into that space, and they weren't going to tell them anything about that. So, because of those choices of not sharing that information, we also don't have access to that information. So, we have to be respectful of those decisions that the ancestors made too. And maybe that's part of what Pablo Talk was doing, is that he was focusing on what he felt comfortable sharing that his ancestors and his elders would have allowed him to.
I think it's such a great example of how one can, or how you can read against the grain, right? And seeing in this omission, we can still learn a lot from that, right? We can understand that there was the ability to have these omissions, and that there continued to be, knowledges that were held within the communities, which in itself is really important for us to understand, right? Even while respecting that we can't know those. Yeah, know that. That's great. Kind of thinking along the same lines, I'm wondering, if you can talk a little bit about how your study of Indigenous art can help shed light on Indigenous perspectives. We've talked a lot now about how difficult it is to get those in the absence of having firsthand testimonies and written records. But yeah, are there other examples of how Indigenous art can shed light on this?
Well, I would say that the material record, the visual record, is a counterpoint to the very biased written record that from this period was dominated by European men who were dismissive of not just indigenous knowledge and perspectives, but even women's knowledge and perspectives. So I haven't really talked too much about the baskets, but in the book I do, and I would say baskets are a good example of women's knowledge, though there were men who also wove and continue to weave, but it has been understood mainly as a women's practice, and that is a container of knowledge. Baskets themselves we can view as containers of knowledge that weavers were passing on their knowledge of how to cultivate the plants, how to use them in the weaving process, the techniques of weaving, and the designs, the patterns that they would weave into them. So in a way, we have some insight to those perspectives, especially with the baskets that were made at the missions that have unique designs, particularly from missions in Buenaventura, where you have the coin-inspired designs intermixed with the indigenous. And the baskets have been written about before, so I'm not taking credit for being the first to talk about them, but I prioritize looking at the indigenous elements to the baskets. For instance, the use of the eagle motif was sort of a subtle way to include an indigenous symbol that would have significance to Chumash and other California Indian people, but may have been lost on the colonizers. To them, they might have thought, oh, the eagle, like the Habsburg eagle. So it was something that had this dual meaning that would mean different things depending on who is doing the looking. So in that sense, we kind of gain a bit more access to the indigenous perspective if we do that close looking.
Yeah, that's a great example, and I'm glad that you bring that up too. And we haven't talked about that as much, as well as kind of the gendered impact of colonial violence back in those days. And I think that's actually a good lead in too to the kind of penultimate question I have for you. But I think just to kind of build on that for a second, I think people. Don't necessarily, people certainly who haven't studied this or learned about it just in grade school, don't really realize to the extent to which California Indian peoples were not patriarchal, right? And women did have places of power and prominence, as with so many indigenous communities, right, all over. And that was really a jarring thing. And I think it's so important to talk about that today as we kind of are living through this kind of return to or re-emphasizing of the patriarchy in our modern world. But leading into that, I think you write a little bit about Toi Perina, who is such a monumental figure, and yet not really talked about on the level that you would imagine someone of her, of who she is to be talked about in California classes, right? We don't learn about Toi Perina at all in any classes. I grew up in LA and never heard about Toi Perina growing up at all. Could you share a little bit about Toi Perina and how important her story is?
Yeah, so Toi Perina was an indigenous medicine woman from a village within our homelands, a Tongva-speaking village, and came from a prominent family. Her father and brothers were Tomyars. They were leaders within the community. And this is in a pre-modern context. So she, Toi Perina was a leader within her village. And at that time, the communities were organized by villages. There was not one large tribe in the sense that we know today, or band is also a term you often hear nowadays. So back then, people were organized into villages. That's how they identified. And she became unhappy, was unhappy with the presence of the colonizers in her homelands, as were other village leaders and individuals living at Mission San Gabriel, Nicolas Jose being her main co-conspirator against Mission San Gabriel. So together they organized an attempted revolt, rebellion against Mission San Gabriel, which the soldiers caught wind of and ultimately prevented Toi Perina and others from carrying out. She was put on trial, and the trial was recorded again as a very biased document because her account was being translated through a Spanish-speaking soldier. So there are a lot of layers of patriarchy in her story, but She, at the time, was seen as a threat, and you can tell from the questions she was being asked in that trial that the government leadership in charge at the time felt threatened by her as a woman, as an Indigenous person, talked down to her. Ultimately, she was banished to the Carmel Mission. If I'm remembering that correctly, she was sent away from her homelands in the Los Angeles area and eventually married a Spanish soldier and started a family there. So she was a survivor. She adapted to her circumstances, and her story is now known among our communities and was celebrated in a play that my community wrote and acted out. I think this was in 2014. I may have the year wrong, but it was an important play to celebrate her legacy and bring the Indigenous perspective to what happened. And even some of her descendants attended the play. So she remains an important figure, but as you were saying, very understudied among the general public of California. So unless you're a scholar of California history or California Indian history, you're not really necessarily going to come across her, which is unfortunate. But because she has been written about in the scholarly community, I didn't spend a whole lot of time on her in the book, but instead introduced her as a way to establish that there had been subsequent prominent women within our community, the Gabrielino Tongva community, who continue to engage with our culture while navigating colonial structures, even when they married outside of our community, to show how there were choices that had to be made that Indigenous women have had to make while finding ways to pass on their knowledge, whether it was through their children or, like in the case of Victoria Reed, her children did not survive, but her knowledge was preserved in the letters that Hugo Reed recorded. So, despite those also being biased, they remain important documents for understanding our culture in the 19th century. So, Toypirina, I would say, is important for many of the reasons I just outlined, but especially for my study, is one of the first to kind of set the stage for subsequent women to be respected in the Los Angeles area, since Victoria Reed was seen as a prominent woman, even at the time, being Indigenous. There are accounts from non-Native women writing about her as someone who was respected and held a high position in society at that time.
Yeah, great. And I think those examples are, yeah, so important to kind of understand kind of the different cultural structures, right? And you know, push back on kind of these ideas of patriarchies are universal. And yeah, and I think her story too, I mean, the erasure of Toypirina's story or the absence of it in a more broad way is so indicative of how little we learn about California and in peoples and culture in California here. Which is just wild that still continues today. But your book does a really beautiful job of helping to push back on that, along with, I think that we're in a time here where there's a lot of great works being done by California Indian scholars like yourself. So I think that that's helping to shift this all. The last question I have to wrap up on, and really grateful for your time here, but just kind of curious on a personal level, you know, what are your hopes? In writing this phenomenal, amazing book here.
Thank you. Well, I wanted to contribute a California Indian perspective, and thankfully, scholars of California Indian heritage came before me to make that possible. So I'm indebted to them for sort of paving the path for the rest of us, especially from this group of scholars you're referring to, who, along with me, have been publishing in recent years, that were able to make those interventions and bring perspectives that earlier generations of scholarship would not have been comfortable reading. Thinking about the Costo book, that was groundbreaking in bringing California Indian perspectives to a scholarly audience, a public audience that probably made some readers uncomfortable. And I imagine my book may do the same, but the goal has been to decenter outdated scholarship, to center material culture, a main topic we've been discussing today, as a valuable source of evidence to understand California Indian choices, perspectives, knowledge, and hopefully inspire other California Indian scholars in other parts of the state to write about their ancestors' practices. Since I'm not covering all 21 missions, I'm only looking at, I think I ended up looking at three. So there's a lot more work to be done, and I would hope that people who are more well-versed in their culture, thinking further up the coast, San Francisco Bay Area, Monterey Bay, would be inspired to do work looking at material culture as well.
Great. Well, I think that you do a good job in doing that and kind of setting that stage and opening those doors. And yeah, hopefully more people will do that. And yeah, I look forward to seeing what your next project is too, because I'm sure that there's a lot more for you to dive into that you're looking to explore next. So thank you so much. I really appreciate your time, and it's great to have seen this, from earlier stages and see it all come together. Thank
Thank
you.
you, Martin.
Thank you for listening to our first episode of the third season of Challenging Colonialism. The speaker in this episode was Dr. Eve Chavez. Her book, Indigenizing California: Mission, Art, and Architecture, is available now, and we'll link to the University of Washington Press in the show notes. Challenging Colonialism is produced by myself, Daniel Stoneblum, and Martin Russo Martinez. All interviews by Martin, all audio engineering and editing by Daniel, all music by G. Gonzalez. Follow us on Twitter, subscribe to the podcast, rate and review on whatever platform you use. Thanks for listening.